Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk, a show dedicated to exploring all aspects of creating a great dental office, where the only dumb question is the question that's not asked. Here's Jim and Han.
Good evening, Jim Jarvis here, along with my co-host Han Tron. Han, how are you?
I'm doing marvelous, Jim. Marvelous. How are you?
Doing well, doing well. Obviously, welcome to Straight Talk, episode number 83. Tonight, we're going to talk about questions and answers, pull in a few things that came in from our last week's discussion. But before we get started on that, Han, I'm not sure if you had noticed or had an opportunity, but, you know, there's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity going on right now in the skies between about sundown and midnight. There's a comet up there. I believe it's called the Neowise comet. And it only comes around, it only comes around every 6,700 years. So if you get a chance to look at it, it'll be literally a once in a lifetime situation.
What part of the sky we're going to see?
Yeah, my wife and I were fortunate enough. We've seen it twice now. Not twice as in two times around its orbit, but obviously in two consecutive days, the weather has been cooperative. But all you got to do is find the Big Dipper. That's usually in the north. Yeah, it's in the northwest portion of the sky. Go directly down from the Big Dipper, between the bottom of the Big Dipper and the horizon, about halfway in between, you'll see the comet. You can almost, if you have really good eyesight in a really dark sky, you can see it without the naked eye, but get a pair of binoculars and it is just cool. You get to see the long tail, the whole nine yards. And it's there until about midnight every night.
Okay, so it's right after sunset or when the sky gets dark, you can start seeing it.
Yep.
We should tell our listener that they can, after they listen to us, then they can go and watch.
Well, exactly. It'd be just about the right time. Up here in northwestern Ohio, about 10:30 is really nice dark skies. But you got to look to the northwest and get the Big Dipper, go directly down. And it's there until the 27th. So you got, basically six more days to be able to check it out. But little side note, interesting, fun, and again, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Very good. Thanks for sharing that, Jim.
Yeah, without a doubt. It's actually very inspiring when you think about it. Tonight's show, back to our questions. We had a lot of feedback from last week's show, and one of the questions that came back, which had to do with the issue of the contractor, and the person was asking about, we had mentioned water tightness of a building. So let's talk a little bit about who's really responsible for water tightness of the building while it's under construction. And what does that even mean? What does water tightness of a building mean? Han, you want to start that off and then I'll follow up?
Yeah, I think basically for me, water tightness means that the entire envelope of the building, including walls and roofs, to be covered, so that there's no water coming into the building. Okay, so let's start with the wall. When the contractor erected the wall, one of the very first thing they need to do is to cover the wall. In most cases, the wall will be some type of a panel unless the wall is masonry block. So for dentist offices, usually it would be light commercial construction, which usually means wood product. And so the exterior wall would normally be covered with some type of a weather barrier, so that when the rain hits it, it doesn't go into the building. When you drive down the road and you see like shopping malls and stuff that are being built, and you see whether it's blue panel, green panel, or yellow panel, those panels are especially made panels that that are water resistant to some extent. The joint is finished, so they keep keep the water from going to the joint. So the wall needs to be covered and protected. That may include opening for doors and windows and what have you, because an open window is just an invitation for water to come in. Okay, you have, besides water, you're going to have other issues with with people, trespasser and so on. So the building needs to be secure. The roof. So when the roof is being built, once you start to, once all the roof panels is in place, the roof and membrane, or at least the building felt or the roof and membrane, or some type of a covering onto the building, so that in case it rain, it doesn't come, it doesn't get into the building. But weather tightness just simply means making sure that the building envelope doesn't get compromised by the elements. Yep.
Yeah, without a doubt. And there was actually three or four hot things you talked about there, one of which is the systems that are out there, the OSB board. That's that kind of funny-looking sheathing board that's put on the outside of your building, made up of chips of wood that have been kind of sandwiched together with glues and resin. Those 2x8 sheets of OSB board are very strong and suitable for exterior, but they're not designed to stay in a weather environment where they're always constantly getting rained on for an extended period of time. So they've come up with this system which allows, basically they've laminated a water resistant membrane to the outside, so that when you put the sheet up and you've got a water resistant membrane on the outside of it, and they tape the joints with a special self-adhesive tape. So effectively you have a barrier the minute the board goes up, which is a materials and methods kind of approach that works perfectly. Now, obviously the architect will specify what kind of panel you want to put up there, but it's the responsibility of the contractor to make sure that it goes up right, that the joints are properly placed, that it's tight, and that the joints are taped so that no water gets in. And Han, you also hit the very important part. You have to deal with the openings where your windows are. So there has to be some kind of potentially temporary waterproofing layer that's going to be there at the opening. A lot of times I've seen contractors that have decided that they're going to frame the wall with the openings in place, the 2x materials that form your wall, and then they take the sheathing and go right over the opening. And so when you first look at your building, you say there's no windows or doors, because they're not cut out yet. And they'll stay that way until they're ready to install the windows, if at all possible, so that it maintains a complete watertight envelope as best possible. It's not designed to stay that away forever, but it'll last, several months while they finish the rest of the construction and get to the point where they put the permanent exterior wall covering, get the windows and doors ready to put in place. They cut out the sheathing and put those in. And so it's an interesting little dance that you have to play as a contractor with the weather, so that you open it up at the right time, get the material installed, you know, doors, windows, exterior siding, whatever you're going to do, and so that it closes it up before the weather comes back again. So, but that's an important aspect that a contractor has to coordinate. Just like you said, the roof is crucial, because we all know, you know, if you have a flat or low sloping roof, you know, it's a great place for water to just lay up there and eventually will seep into the building. Or if you have a sloped roof and you're putting shingles on it, they might put down something called Ice and Water Guard, which is a name brand for basically a sticky, self-adhesive, rubberized membrane that's self-healing, and they stick that onto the roof sheathing, and effectively you have a watertight building until they get the shingles placed on, or the metal roof, or whatever you're going to put up there. So all of that has to be thought about. Yes, hon?
The water and ice dam, that is worth the money to invest in, right?
Oh, it's an exceptionally good material and a wonderful performing product, so much so that we almost always specify it to completely cover a sloping roof system that you're going to put shingles on. Just because
it makes sense.
You don't want your pants to fall down, right? And so if your suspenders break, your belts will hold it up. But if your belt breaks, your suspenders better hold it up. If you don't have both, you know, you're going to drop your drawers. Well, that's the same thing with that material. You don't want water in.
You know, I have ran into a contractor who actually preferred to use the water and ice dam for the covering of the entire roof. You see that a lot down here in Florida. Because when you go the traditional way, that you have shingle roof, the traditional method is you put down the tarp paper, and then you get the shingle up. And so between the time that you put the tarp paper down and the shingle up, it could be a day or two. A storm come along, rip up the tarp, and then you have to, you know, the tarp paper, and then you have to go back and reinstall them or patch them or whatever. So you have a compromised underlayment underneath that shingle if you don't do it right. So they figure, you know, it's worth a little extra money, you know, the labor and all that stuff. It just makes sense for them to put down the water and ice dam. We don't get ice down in Florida, but that's the name of the brand. So they put it down, it sticks down, and they can sleep, they sleep well at night, and next day or two or three, when they come back to it, and they can put down the shingle and off they go. No problem.
Right. And that's the same reason why we do it up here and basically specify it for anywhere else around the country, is just that reason. You can get your sheathing your roof sheathing goes up, and then you can have the ice and water dam or the ice guard system adhere directly to it immediately, and then the roofing contractor can come in and do the roof, you know, in the next few days. So it's that whole scenario where you have, you know, let's say you have a contractor or subcontractor that's busy because he's good. Well, he may not be ready on Tuesday to put it on, but he could do it on Thursday. Well, there's 2 days that potentially you could be in trouble if it were to rain. But if you have the ice and water guard down, then you don't have to worry about it. And so that's the reason why those contractors like to do it that way. It saves them the headache and stomach acid of worrying about, oh man, is that wind going to blow off that temporary felt paper that I put up there with a billion capped nails and staples? 9 times out of 10, it gets blown off. And we've seen that happen. We've seen that happen on jobs. I mean, construction jobs, you're up in the middle of the sky, and there's nothing around, and you get a lot of wind, and that wind will catch something and it'll rip something right off a building instantly. We've seen it with building wrap. See, that's another possible way of providing a water resistant membrane around your building is a building wrap stuff. Typical brand is called Tyvek. There's a few others out there. Almost every lumber yard has their own version, and they advertise by splashing their name across it. And but that system is basically comes in big sheets that you roll around the building. You staple it in place with a bazillion staples, and it just stays there. You cut out the windows when you're tying. So that's another way of doing it. But again, to answer the question that was raised, the water tightness is really the general contractor's responsibility, but it starts with the architect, meaning what they specify as the type of system to be installed. Anything more on that subject, Hon?
Yes. Let's say the process of covering the building wasn't done in a timely manner, and water gets into the building. Okay, water, snow, whatever the element bring, and it present a problem inside the building, such as you get the floor deck all wet. The inside temperature and all that stuff is just perfect for mold growth. So when that stuff happens, who is responsible for cleaning up the mess?
Well, you brought up the scenario of the, oh, crap, that's as bad, because that's exactly what happens. It's like a snowball going down a hill. It eventually turns into an avalanche. Once it happens, and once you get water into the building, there are a cascading amount of potential problems, and they have to be addressed very quickly, and they have to be addressed correctly. To answer your question, is who's responsible? The who's responsible, 9 times out of 10, more like 99% of the time, is the contractor. The contractor is responsible because they're responsible for materials, means, and methods. That falls under methods, meaning they should have properly installed this watertight membrane, be it temporary or permanent, whatever it needs to be, to keep the water out. Now, thankfully, the manufacturers of things like OSB board and a few other products that historically do get wet have taken it into account, and they create products that are designed to get a little wet occasionally and get drying out, and they're okay. But things like drywall, for example, that's bad news. If you get drywall that has gotten wet because it was maybe placed too soon or there was an issue with whatever above, 9 times out of 10, that drywall is coming out. You've got to take it out, and you've got to clean out whatever nasty stuff might be behind it, because it does not take long to grow mold. You can grow mold literally almost overnight. And once it's there, you've got to get rid of it properly. And that's a whole subject in itself about mold remediation and what you have to do there and drying out product and everything else. I mean, we could go on for 2.5 shows on just that subject alone. But it is a relatively costly experience and can run into the thousands of dollars pretty quickly.
Now, when that happened, okay, even though it is the contractor responsible for, you know, for maintaining a dry, safe, watertight environment. If mold and all that stuff grows or started to grow, and he had to take care of that. Is there room for him to come back to the owner and say, hey, I didn't plan this into the project, and it wasn't my fault, and yada yada, and I need you to cough up extra money to remedy this?
They'll ask. Our recommendation would be the answer is no, because it's not the owner's responsibility for the methods and the means of construction. That's why they were hired. That's why the contractor was given the fee that they were given. They take on that liability and they take on that responsibility. Now, if you as the owner have said some things or agreed to some things, that's where you got to be really careful. You got to be really careful about what you say or do with the contractor without your architect being around, because you could be agreeing to something because the contractor got himself into a pickle, and next thing you know, you're looking at a bill for thousands of dollars to remediate something. So again, what was my last comment when we had our show last week? Let
your
do that
your,
with my architect.
That's right. So, that is the best. That's the best line to say.
Write that down. Memorize it. If you're doing a project, you know, do not agree to anything without your architect being involved, because you know, that's what we're there for. We're there as your advocates. We have the experience. We do this all the time. We've been doing it for many, many, many years, especially if you get the good ones, and we should be able to help you out and keep you out of trouble, because you could be looking at tens of thousands of dollars, and we've seen it, haven't we not? We're you know, thousands of dollars to remediate a mold issue on a building, everything from treating, the airing it out, dehumidification, and then certification based around testing. I mean, the zeros just start adding up real fast. And we've even had building officials say, we will not let you move forward in any further construction until they have certification from an independent testing laboratory that says that the mold that was observed because the contractor failed to do something on the roof has been removed and remediated. And that's the worst case scenario, because the job gets shut down.
Yeah, that's right. What Jim just said, translating to English, is that your project will be delayed for weeks.
Months.
Possibly months, because it's difficult to dry out a building that has been soaked. Water migrate to the lowest level. It get in between, structural members and what have you, and it takes time to dry them out. If you have mechanical systems already in place, that would be a little easier, but it still takes time. So just imagine that nobody can go into the building because of mold. It's not safe for human occupancy. It will be a drastic hit on your time schedule.
Right. Here's another example.
Yeah.
Here's another example that we've seen you got to be real careful with. And I know we almost spent our whole half of our show on this one question, but let's say you have a basement or you have a crawl space, but more so you have a basement, and it happens to rain during the construction period, and for whatever reason, water gets into the basement, whether the downspout areas have not been properly connected, but whatever, water gets in there. Do not let your contractor just let that water sit down there. And we've seen it, haven't we, Hondi? It's like, you know, you could stock fish in this lake. I mean, it's the water's so deep. You got to get that water out of there. The longer water sits within an envelope, a building envelope, even if it's a basement, even if it's just a poured concrete basement, which is the most durable wall system you can think of, get that water out of there. They've got to get pumps in there, and they've got to pump that water out and away. You do not want to have water sitting down there, especially if it's in between season and you might have a situation where you might have freezes and the next day it's a little bit, it thaws and the next day it freezes, that will tear havoc on your building. And that the damage I was, actually, your car is nasty.
Yeah, I was gonna say that. The freeze, you know, if you, regardless whether you're in the area where you're gonna have freeze and thaw condition, just the fact you have water inside the building, it evaporates, it gets rancid, it just creates all kind of problems that you may see or you may not see. So let's say you look at it and you go visually and say, there's no water in the building, and you start, and the contractors start to put up the drywall and stuff like that, but the moisture content in the building itself will soak up, you know, the material that's installed will soak it up, and you have a totally different issue. It may not show up right away, but it will, and when it surfaces, it becomes a disaster to remedy. So it's important that, you know, that the building is watertight, safeguard, and in the event that there's water that gets into the building, it needs to be evacuated as quickly as possible. You want to minimize problems.
It's easier to minimize and a lot less expensive than it is to try to remedy afterwards, especially when you're dealing with water. Water is one of the hardest things you can deal with when it comes to construction site. Okay, let's jump to the next question, which was kind of an interesting one, and it had to do with a project that was ongoing. It happens to be a renovation of an existing dental facility, and they put on a small addition, and there, because of the grade change, there's a need for a ramp. Now, in this particular project, the back door to the building is mostly where the employees go in and out. Okay, you don't have any patients. You'll get employees, maybe an occasional delivery, but mostly just employees. But there's I think it was almost 22 inches of vertical rise that had to be dealt with. So you had to put in a ramp. The reason why the ramp was necessary, because you say, why don't you just put in some stairs? Well, you could have. We could have put some stairs in because the front door is handicap accessible. And right, Hong, you only have to have one door into a building to be handicap accessible to meet code, correct?
Yes, only one of the door have to be ADA compliant.
Right. And so if the front door, which in this particular case is, then you don't have to really put a ramp in the back. But the reason why the ramp came about was the need for emergency crew and bringing in a gurney. If, for heaven forbid, there was a situation you needed to take a patient out on a gurney, you don't want to have them run down a bunch of stairs out the back of the building. And of course, the imagery of having somebody wheeled out the front door in a gurney is not the greatest thing. So that's why having them go out the back entrance where the employees come in and out facilitated a need for the ramp. So the ramp doesn't have, that particular ramp does not have to meet handicap code, which is 1 in 12, meaning, you know, for every 12 inches, you get 1 inch of vertical rise. So like if you have 22 inches of vertical rise, you're going to have 22 feet of ramp. Now, there's some particulars about handicap ramps that kind of are interesting, Han, when you're doing the research. You know, I think our listeners might make at least benefit from that knowledge.
Yeah, actually, the code has a little bit of flexibility in ramp design. Typically, if you have the ability to design the ramp where the slope is 1 inch for a vertical rise and for every 20 inch of horizontal distance, which is 1:20 ratio, then you don't have to have handrails. Okay. Actually, at that slope, it was more like considered a walk rather than a ramp. But if you have a short run and you need to have a more steeper pitch to the ramp, then for new construction, it is a maximum of 1:12. Like Jim was saying earlier, is that one for every inch in vertical rise, you have 12 inches in horizontal travel. Okay. Then in the ramp, there's other elements too. It got to be as wide, you know, it got to be a minimum 36 inches wide. You can only run it for 30 feet long, and then you have to have a level landing. Okay, and that landing had to be the same width of the ramp, and it had to be 5 feet in horizontal run. Now in this situation Jim was describing, the flexibility, there's some exception in the rule, is that because it's an existing site, then the pitch of the ramp could be greater. But in any case, you want to, if there's any way at all, you want that ramp to be have that slope pitch as possible, because it become more arduous to use if the slope is too steep. Jim, did I give you enough information?
Yeah, exactly. And you're right, because the issue has to do with, is it considered a handicap ramp or not considered a handicap ramp? Even if it's not considered a handicap ramp, we still like to follow the rules around the handicapped ramp as much as possible, if possible. But you're right, there is that flexibility. And, that's the mark of a good designer, who understands that you have some flexibility there to make these kind of things work. Because a lot of times, maybe you don't have enough room to do an actual true handicap ramp issue. So I hope that answers the question, at least in regards to that particular situation. We, if you're doing a brand new construction, and then obviously it's a lot easier to solve or figure out. This really falls into that realm of additions or renovations and that kind of stuff. Well, let me add another
bit to this, because it's an existing building, it's a renovation. It is important. I don't want to say make this like a self-promoting. Okay, it could be anyone who practice architecture and who design buildings and so on. Those who know what to do. Those who don't will bless you with the headache. Let me give you a prime example. I was looking at a proposed design for a building that's going to be renovated, and the proposal was to have a doctor's office to the front of the building, and it has a door to it. And it was shared with me that that door was, the location of the doctor was there so that the doctor can take advantage of the existing exterior door. And those who know how to look at building and look at the design would say, you have a building, that door leads to the back of a building. If it's meant for the doctor to use as his private in and out, there will have to be a sidewalk that leads him or her to the parking area that may be on the other side of the building. Okay, so what I know of that particular design was that that door put them out onto a patio, a small little patio. So you have to look at all the components of the building and whether the design makes sense or not. If that proposal puts you into a door to lead you to nowhere that you can't use, that you have to spend another $20,000-$30,000 to develop the site and the parking and all that to allow you to use it, It doesn't make sense, at least in our assessment anyway. So look at everything, not just simply what sounds good. All right, Jim?
Yep, makes absolute sense. All right, here's a question that came in relationship to our last week's show, and let me set the stage. The person's under construction. They're in the middle of the renovation of a project, and then he asks, what happens when there's a design change, and how should that be processed? So that, keep it in mind, their mindset is, what do I do and how do I protect myself so that the contractor doesn't, you know, effectively extort me for tons and tons of money? So with that in mind, Han, I'll let you tackle it first. So we've got a design change. You know, okay, something changed on the project. We don't know who caused the design change, whether it was a mistake or the owner said, I changed my mind. The owner's staff got involved after the fact when they should have been involved earlier, and something changed. So what happened?
Yep. Excellent, Jim. You cover all the bases. So the change can come from the contractor, can come from the owner, can come from other sources that may or may not represent the owner, and so on, regardless of who initiate the discussion of the change. The change could be as simple as move this door. Okay, whatever the change is, very few
I'm
times.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh, but when you use the word simple and move in the same sentence,
it doesn't happen. Okay.
It doesn't happen.
Yeah. No, there's nothing. There is nothing simple, because it's almost like, you know, an inflated balloon. All right. There's an X volume of air. You push on one side, it's going to go out. It's going to expand that balloon throughout to this, you know, to make up that volume. So a change in a building is very much like that. That simple relocation of door affects a lot of other stuff. It's not as simple as, oh, I only want a door move. Okay? We look at that everything works somewhat symbiotic together. So what is that that saying that Einstein had? It's that there's an action. There's always a equal force and reaction, something like that?
Yeah, there's always an equal and opposite reaction.
Right? Yeah. Okay, so when there is a change, typically the people that will be responsible initially to make sure that everything that associated with that change are reviewed, looked at, and provide the necessary technical input that's required that associated with that change. That usually would be your architect and or his, the rest of the design team, the engineers and so on. That change could affect, it will affect architectural. It may affect electrical, mechanical, plumbing. It could affect all the discipline on the project. Okay? So everybody that's responsible for the construction issue, the technical stuff, need to be on board with that change. The worst thing that could happen is you go to, you know, the contractor and say, make that change. The contractor did it and nobody else know about it. And then when it's brought to the architect's attention, you go, that change had caused a non-compliant issue associated with this or that or that. And that happened. Yeah, it happened more than we like to see. Okay, so bring the architects into the discussion. The architect will look at everything and convey that to the contractor. The contractor will tell you how much it will cost to make that change, how long it will take to make that change. The changes are rarely ever have a negative or credit effect. It's always had an add, an added cost effect. And so once the contractor, if the provide the cost and the schedule, If it would affect the schedule, he will convey that to the team as well. Then the architect will present the owner with the course of action and the recommendation, and at that time the owner will say, yes, let's do that. No, we won't do that. Okay, but that is, and then once the contractor get the approval, the signed approval, because this is done in paper, in writing. Once the contractor get approval, that's when he move forward with it. He don't build it and then come back and tell you, yes, I make the change. This is what it costs. Okay, that's the worst thing that happened. But make sure that architect is on board with everything. Because if the architects are not aware that you had tell the contractor to move this, move that, then I can both to help you when the bill come in and you say, what happened? Yeah, I got a $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 change order. You say, I have no idea. You approved that. We did not. Jim?
Right, exactly. And you hit on a dozen very important points. Basically, let's just break it down into a couple scenarios. First of all, if the design change is caused by you or your staff, okay, more than likely there will be additional costs incurred. Sometimes it's not, but more than likely there is. And you will have to effectively pay for that. So there'll be additional changes in the compensation, both to the design team, because they're sure there's going to be design rework, along with the construction company, the general contractor. So you'll have all of that information before the work is started. Now, if the design change was caused by the contractor, and there could be a dozen different reasons for that, could be, I can't get the material that was specified. It no longer is available. I can't do something like this system because that particular group of subcontractors who do that work are not available and they don't work within the within my schedule. So they may come back and say, hey, can we use this material or use this system? And that causes a design change. And when I say a design change, that's correct, because it could be, and more than likely will be, there will be changes in design, even if you change out a different system or a different material or a different window or a different door or anything, there potentially will be a design change. Now, on that one, it's going to be, we'll have to make the determination based on the specifics. It may be that the contractor will pay for the design changes, both the fees for us to do our work and our engineers, along with them and their subcontractors to do their work, if it was something that he caused or she caused in regards to the project. Now, if it was a design change that was caused by an external entity, how about a building department or an inspector or a fire marshal or someone else who came into the project and caused a design change? Then we'll have to evaluate. Was this something that should have been foreseen or should have been known about or was addressed before by somebody else, and then this inspector changed it. So then we get involved and we have to negotiate and work out with the building department and the inspection team. Or was it something that they have the authority to do? And we've run into that before. And pretty much they will hold you hostage and say, you'll do it my way or you'll never get your certificate of occupancy. So you end up footing the tab for that because you want your certificate of occupancy to move in. Now, there could also be a design change based upon scene. Let's say we started to dig something and all of a sudden there's this world's biggest granite boulder located exactly where you were going to put your elevator? Well, it has to be evaluated as to, all right, do we blast the boulder out of place and all the expense necessary to be able to put your elevator in place, or do you redesign the project and move your elevator? We'll provide you with the necessary information and cost either way, and you can make a determination of which way it goes. But on that scenario, you're going to end up paying for that. That falls under unforeseen. It's not the contractor's responsibility or fault. It's not the design team's responsibility or fault. It's just part of doing business. That's why we always say have a contingency in your project where you have some money set aside. Most lending institutions are good ones, so we require that you have a contingency for just that particular reason. So I guess the big thing that I take about from this whole discussion, Han, is never go this alone. Having the design team, having the architect all the way through, including completion through construction, is crucial. Because we're there to help you get this thing finished. And we can save you thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars so that you don't get taken advantage of by someone else because you don't know. And it's not because you're not a smart person. No, you're a very smart person. I mean, that's a given. But you don't know construction. And you don't know design, and you don't know that world. That's our world, and that's why we sweat those details, and we'll let you deal with the patients and dentistry. Right, Han?
That's right. Hey, let me give you just a really quick example. Okay, what you don't know, you don't know. We have a design where we have a really nice reception desk, and we all want things to be symmetrical, right? Because it looks natural, it looks beautiful. But there's codes that require that you need to accommodate if you want to get your certificate of occupancy. Usually, the reception desk is designed with a high-low counter, and the low counter is for ADA requirement. We have a project under construction. Everybody knows, including the owner. Why things are put in place during the construction process. The owner and his office manager walking through, and she said, "Why is that there? I would rather not have that." And go, "Oh yeah, that's a good idea. Let's just close that." Now, first of all, in this case, the office manager was not part of the design team. It was not part of the discussion. And I'm going to put this up bluntly. We highly recommend that you have one person on your side of the table speak on your behalf, whether it's you or your office manager or your representative, whoever it is. The biggest problem on any construction project is communication, lack of or miscommunication. So the more people involved, the more documentation is required. Every little piece of information that's not conveyed to the major decision maker or the entire team, it could lead to a lot of financial problems down the road. So in this case, it was the decision to close up that low counter was made and then given the directive to the contractor to correct.
Bypassing the architect.
That's right. The architect never was involved in that discussion. We become the janitor on the project afterward, okay? Because when that was discovered, we will have to figure out how do you salvage that design so that you can provide an ADA counter to at least address that requirement. In this case, that counter become behind the take-back door rather than in front at the reception. It become part of the checkout rather than part of the check-in. even though the checkout already have the ADA, counter to accommodate that on the other side of the counter. So it create design problem. It create code issue problem. The building inspector didn't have too much of an issue. Otherwise, he could simply say, correct that, return it back to the way it was designed. And that way, you suddenly, the owner, pay for it to be built, pay for it to be demolished, pay for it to be demolished and rebuilt. That doesn't make sense. So it's really crucial that you include those who know the building, know the code, know the ramification, know the function and all that stuff, so that you don't make the wrong decision to wastelessly spend time and money to doing the things wrong. Jim?
Yeah, that's how a simple thing like moving a door could effectively be thousands and thousands of dollars. And you don't want to spend that money, and we don't want to watch you spend that money, because it's not in anybody's best interest. So hopefully that was a pretty good, thorough understanding of design changes while you're under construction. We've got a few minutes left, and I want to sneak this one in, Han, because I think we can do it. Let's talk about material substitutions, how and what, and this is coming from the doctor. When should I ask for a credit?
Material substitution, the process is very similar to a change order. If there is, let's say for whatever reason, the material that was specified on the project was not able to be acquired on a timely manner, whatever the reason is, and the contractor decide, I can, instead of providing this product A that was specified, it's going to come in 8 weeks and it's going to delay the project. Can we do something else? And let me propose this product B. Now, the contractor, the right way to do it is that the contractor present that material substitution to the architect, so that the architect can review it, compare it, make sure that he's getting apple to apple substitution. If the product is a more inferior product but still perform and it's acceptable because of the time constraint or whatever the reason is, he or she will present, analyze it, present it to the owner, and the contractor will also, for the substitution, should also present the cost difference in material. So that way, one, it either is going to cost more for the product, or two, or it's going to cost less. So at least the benefit to the owner is that he or she will get the benefit of a credit, or he or she get the benefit of spending more for something else. But it needs to be presented at the beginning of the conversation of, we have problem, we can't get this, we need to do this, can we? The contractor can't arbitrarily simply replace or substitute a product. If the contractor decides to do that, then at that time, the architect should analyze it and determine whether it is a substitution of equal value, equal performance, and so on, and whether it's just a wash, or there is money coming back to the owner. If the contractor replace or substitute the product, and it costs more for the contractor, and he or she did it on their own without prior approval, my position, our position, the architect position, should also consult with the owner, is that the difference should be a gift. The owner should not pay any more for what is substitute, even if it is a better product. Jim?
Or higher cost. Now,
yes.
Here's one important aspect of this, and real quick. The important aspect about a material substitution is you have to do it right. You have to do your homework, and you have to have it done properly in advance. And here's what I'm saying. Let's say that let's go, you have brick on your building. There's brick A, which is what we specified, but it can't be purchased because of whatever. Went out of stock, not available, had to be shipped from other side of the country, whatever. It's the one you guys picked, you like, the owner likes, but it's not available. So the contractor says, I can get brick B, which looks really kind of similar, and we review it, and we say, yeah, it looks, it'll perform, it has the necessary product data information, and everything works good. But the contractor said, well, it's just a wash, or it's going to cost you another, you know, several thousand dollars. You have no base point to compare that to. So what we like to recommend is that when you get your contractor back when they're doing their bid and they're giving you the cost, don't let them give you just a lump sum cost, meaning I'm going to do your new building is going to cost $1.52 million. And we'll do it to the drawings and specification. Well, that might be great, but we don't know what they're using. When we say the drawings and specifications, a lot of times we say this kind of brick or specified equal. And they may have picked something equal, but you never know what that cost is. You never know what he put in his or she put in their bid for the cost. So what we recommend is you get a breakdown, what's called unit pricing, on some of these important things, preferably a lot of important things, but as much as you can get, so that you know before they come to the table and say, we need to have a few extra dollars to do this. You already know that brick A costs $1,000 and they're substituting brick B, and brick B only costs $800 a unit. So there shouldn't be an additional cost. In actuality, that's when you should ask for a credit, because there should be a credit coming back. Because if you leave it up to the contractor, and I'm sorry to say this, but 9 times out of 10, unless you have a very, very, very good contractor, you'll never see dollar for dollar come back out of a project on a substitution. It just doesn't happen. So if you have the base point, you have that amount in the original bid, keep it, have your architect have it, you have it, you have it as part of your contract with the general contractor, then you have something to refer to. So if they come back and say, well, that HVAC equipment that I had originally bid isn't available, but I can get this other stuff because the other stuff is going to be 12 weeks out because they're so busy and they can't make it, but I can have this system, but it's going to cost you $10,000 more. Well, what's the unit cost for that equipment? What's the cost of the new equipment? And we evaluate it and make the determination. Is it really worth $10,000 more? Or is it a system that is equal or less? So that's a very, very important part of this. How many times, Han, in our show have we said construction is a nasty business?
It's a dirty business. It's not nasty. It's a very dirty business.
Wonderful contractors, it can be a joy, but if you don't, it can be the world's worst nightmare.
Yes. Jim, let me throw one in when we're talking about product substitution. And it does, and often, you know, it's not as simple. Sometimes it's just simple as, can I use this paint instead of that paint? Or can I use this brick instead of that brick? The worst scenario is going to just an opposite or totally different building systems. Okay,
yeah.
And this is important. You hear the phrase, the devil's in the is in the detail, and the detail is writing. If the contractor tells you, you say, let me see, I'd like to change, I'd like to put on brick on this building instead of going with, hardy board siding, okay? And the contractor tells you, no problem, it's zero cost extra. If you didn't put that in writing, you're going to have to open your pocketbook sooner or later for the additional cost. See, when you
because
change material.
We know it's not zero.
That's right, okay? Because changing building system or cladding system require a totally different process, different details, different additional materials and things like that. It's never a neutral, $0 change. So unless you have it in writing to say the change from this to that, including everything associated with the design that's required for this new material, is zero cost, zero added cost. You don't have a leg to stand on because they'll come for you. They're going to either take something out or you're going to pay for more and or settle for less. It happens all the time. So
too much. It happens too much.
Yes.
And the contractor will not give you that breakdown. Think twice, think three times before you hire that contractor.
A good contractor will have no problem open the book and give you the numbers you need.
Yep.
Okay. A good contractor will. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Those who are operating on a shoestring, who doesn't know, what the process is that are practiced in industry, it's going to hurt you on the long run. You can look at the number at the bid and you say, oh, hey, there's a difference between, the bidder one and bidder two. There's $200,000 difference. Okay, I'm going to go with the cheap one. At the end of the project, you're gonna say, dang it, I wish I would have picked the other one because I'm now 2 months behind and I have a change order for $400,000. I spent $400,000 more because they forgot this one, they forgot that, right? Make sure you have good representation and a contractor that know what they're doing and can prove it. Jim?
Definitely. Well, hopefully we've gone a few minutes again over time, hon. We're getting into a rhythm here, unfortunately. Again, thank you for being part of our show, listening to what we had to say. Hopefully it's been helpful. We look forward to spending next week with you, going over a whole bunch of other good stuff. And as always, if you have any questions, if you have anything you want us to review, get it to us. You can get us through our website. All that information is available out there. So, again, thank you, and hopefully it's been helpful. And, Han, I'll let you have the last word.
Yeah, I'll take the brunt of the blame for going over time. Certainly enjoy spending the hour with you. I hope it's been fun and educational. Stay safe. Until next time, have a good evening.
You've been listening to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk with Jim and Han. To contact us and find out more info about upcoming shows, please log on to our website at www.hjtdesign.com. Until next time.